the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. My name's Anne-Marie Sheedy, Director of Global Partnerships at ExchangeWire, and I'm hosting today. But I'm thrilled to be joined by Ozzy, Programmatic Lead at Thomson Reuters. Hello, Ozzy.
How are you doing?
And Matt Broughton, our senior editor at ExchangeWire. Hi, Matt.
Hello to you, Anne-Marie. How are you?
I'm very well, apart from a bit tongue-tied this morning for some reason. But we'll crack on and hopefully, you know, it'll resolve itself as we work our way through. I'm going to crack on and kick into our first story, which is about the DMA antitrust legislation. Now, that's the Digital Markets Act, not the Direct Marketing Association. This week, the EU has revealed its strongest legislative effort yet to bring balance to the tech world and increase the ability of smaller players to compete. For reference, smaller scale cases such as the €50 million worth of antitrust fines accumulated by Apple in the Netherlands over their lack of compliance with third-party payments for dating apps have made the tech headlines. But the DMA is set to be the first real set of reforms to address the wider issues across the industry. The Act will define companies such as Meta, Apple and Google as gatekeepers and demand their interoperation with smaller companies to create an open and contestable market. Lack of cooperation will lead to steep fines up to 10% of turnover. Ozzy, I'm going to come to you first on this one. And what I'd like to know is what you think will be in regards to the kind of proposed DMA. How do you feel it's going to kind of rein in the power of big tech?
Yeah, it's a really good one. I'm actually looking forward to it, mainly because I think it's really around creating like competition. And it's also about creating a more fair and equitable marketplace. And I think for so long, the so-called big players, if you want to call them that, have, you know, kind of always favored their own services and their own platforms. And I think, you know, this might actually spawn the dawn of kind of new tech giants, you know, or new digital giants or new players in a way that we've never seen before. And, you know, I welcome the law because actually I don't think there's been a change to that, to that Competition Act for maybe about 20 years or maybe longer than that. Mm. And when you think about it, the internet has changed so much things in the last year alone. You know, everybody's working from home now, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, but before that, you know, the scale in which, you know, these tech players have grown, you know, and marginalized and I guess, you know, cornered parts of the market, you know, whilst we love that they create products that, you know, make our lives easier. On the other hand, I like alternatives, and one of the alternatives I like using is like Signal. But I can't get my friends to text me back on Signal. Mm. I mean, I got a couple of group chats on Signal, so I'm quite happy about that. But I think, you know, you mentioned about interoperability. I can never say that word properly. I think it's great to have those alternatives in place in the market now. You know, and I think it's great that, you know, people can download, might be able to buy their products and not have to, for example, with the iPhone, you don't have to use the pre-installed apps, you know, if that's one of the proposals, you know. Mm. I think it's a good signal for the industry. I think it's a welcome change for sure. I mean, that's just my take on it. But I know there'll be a lot of difficulty in terms of when it comes into force. You know, I think it's the end of this year, January as well. But there's a period in which there's a grace period in which some of those organizations have to adhere to it as well. So, yeah, you know, I welcome it. I think it'd be good for sure.
Interesting. Yeah, you talk about the big players and, you know, bringing more of those in. Into the game. They defined gatekeepers as firms with a market cap of at least €75 billion or $82 billion. They also think they said they have to have 45 million monthly users. And they talk about these firms being like an app or a social network. So, Matt, I mean, what are your overall thoughts on this?
I completely agree with Ozzy in that it's a positive step for ensuring the accountability of big tech platforms. I can't remember how many times on this podcast we've said these platforms are lacking that accountability. And as Ozzy said, traditional anti-competition laws haven't done enough to disincentivize that. The Dutch authorities are charging, you know, the maximum possible 50 million euros, but that equates to just 0.01% of Apple's revenue. If you had £1 million in one hand, you just have to give £150 of that back.
Yep.
And that's not strong enough. So the proposed 10% initially, and then 20% for repeat offences, and also a blanket ban on acquisitions for repeat offenders, that's a bit more meaty. But I think the key within the kind of proposed Digital Markets Act will be that kind of behavioural and structural remedies, which they've outlined. And it's kind of the enforcement of that, which I think will be key. Because as we've discussed previously, in terms of GDPR, where there's been a kind of piecemeal and kind of unclear enforcement of that, that doesn't really benefit anyone. So if they can get that enforcement piece right, then I think it could be a very strong piece of legislation.
Hopefully, but I mean, it's all been reviewed at the moment. It's going to come down to the language and people are going to unpick it. But Ozzy, go on, you've got your finger up there looking for attention.
No, you made a really good point, because I was going to talk about GDPR just very briefly, because actually, not necessarily enforcement, I think the overall implementation of it end to end, some people have felt it's okay, some have gone it's a shambles, and I think the failings of GDPR in some respects is kind of what the DMA have to kind of learn from, in that, you know, we have to ensure, not necessarily enforce, it's really easy to say you've got a fine here, but actually it's ensuring that, actually, to your point, that accountability is pretty much up and down, you know, top to down, in terms of if this company is getting this sort of treatment, any others that basically cross the same line have to also get the same type of treatment.
Because
I think there are some, in some parts of Europe, GDPR is great. In other parts of Europe, it's not so great. I've not heard any cases in the UK about, you know, GDPR is being adhered to in the way it should be. And I think that's where the problem is. There's no like a uniform consensus. And I think that's where the DMA have to be really clear around, you know, that act has to be really clear around, doesn't matter where you are, where you live, if you're in Europe, this is what it means. This is how we're going to punish you. And this is how it'll be implemented. And I think that message has to be concise from the European Council all the way down to, you know, our old individual bodies and organisations that are within the industry.
But how would you move that conversation on? If you took it in terms of there's two sides of the coin, you started saying, you know, yourself, you're trying to get your friends to use Signal, etc. So there's a kind of behavioural change that needs to happen, and then there's going to be kind of some structural remedies. And if we go from the consumer side, so all your mates are on WhatsApp or using iMessages or whatever, you want to get them onto Signal. But then if you look at it from a business perspective, you talked about that we use certain platforms because they make our life easy, right? And I think we all know who we're talking about there. And some would say that they own, you know, 95% of the market in some situations. But if I'm going to call it out and kind of say, right, what if you could prove that YouTube has a monopoly? Why can't third parties have access to the data and the, you know, industry inventory that they've got there? So any DSP could have access, for example. Would that work in our favour, do you think? Or will that actually play out? I'm going to come to you, Ozzy, on that, please.
I don't really know. Yeah. I can't answer that question. I think, to take it back to the question, I think it's about choice. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, people have not been given the choice that they want. One of the reasons I don't own said phone, you know, it's because of choice. Because, you know, I like to feel like I want to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, and whatever. I don't feel like I want to sign up to a certain store and have my email address and my contact details on there. And that's my choice. But also, I think maybe because I work in advertising, I'm acutely aware that there isn't. That sometimes people aren't given that choice. So, you know, most people will kind of just go with what's prescribed for them if given the opportunity to do that. But then there are that percentage of people who don't want to do that. And I think the more people understand that they don't have to do, I think GDPR is a really good example, actually, in that once you started asking people, do you want to share your information? There was some people, I'm not going to say it's a lot of people, but there were some people who were like, no, I don't. right? And I think that's a signal shift of, you know, just take it as it is and take it as it's always been, you know. And I think this will have a similar impact once some of your friends realize that actually they don't need to be, because most people don't want to leave said app, because if it's like, oh, actually all my group chats are on there, it's like, I don't want to leave, I don't know, said streaming platform because all my playlists are on there. And I think once people start having a choice and know that actually you can message your friends on whatever you want to, and you know that it's privacy compliant, then I'm sure you might see a shift in people's behavior. And people aren't stupid. I think the general public are becoming a lot more savvy, a lot more smarter than, you know, where we were, like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So, you know, everybody's should be a digital native these days. Everybody has a smartphone. So I definitely think, like, choices will be a big part to play in, you know, how people want to consume or use certain products and services moving forward. So I think that's what my take on it. I can't speak from an advertising perspective and a data sharing perspective because I don't know nearly enough around the act and some of the intricacies of it, but, you know, I guess we'll know more when that comes out. So
you make some really good points there. You know, it's choice and education and understanding, and I think sometimes we overlook that because we're in a bubble of ad tech and martech, and we live and breathe it all the time. And I think we need to remind ourselves that at the end of the day, it's people, and we want to make people's. I want my life to be easy, so I'm not going to jump off one platform. And I'm, you know, I just click accept on half the things because it's easy, right? Am I going to go and read through it? And, you know, we talk and have been talking for ages about the 20%ers. But ultimately, I think and I hope this act will actually make tech open and competitive. And that, I think, will make it healthier. Matt, you're nodding. Is there anything else you wanted to add in there?
Yeah, just kind of on that flip side in terms of the advertiser perspective, I kind of delved into the kind of proposed text because I'm that interesting. But part of the text reads, transparency obligations should therefore require gatekeepers to provide advertising publishers to whom they supply online advertising services when requested and to the extent possible with information that allows both sides to understand the price paid for each of the relevant advertising services. So that implies that they are opening this up, maybe not necessarily to third-party tech providers, but certainly in terms of the advertisers and publishers, just kind of building that kind of more dialogue there. And I know kind of one of the main criticisms of big tech platforms is that it have been a bit opaque in how that kind of reporting comes through. So again, another positive step that they're looking to open things up.
Hopefully, and that actually leads us nicely onto the second story, which is kind of about transparency. And this is taken from the headline from an article in The Information, is advertisers unexpectedly see recovery after Apple mess. You know, of course, you're going to click in and go, Apple mess, what are you talking about? But when you do look into it a little more detail, after ad tracking transparency knocked nearly $10 billion of revenue from the likes of Facebook, Twitter, Snap, the industry fears the new measures, private relay and hide my email, will have a similar impact. Now, despite the changes and the ripple effect of Apple's measures that saw advertisers leaving Facebook in search of greater returns, it's being reported that Zuckerberg's platform is seeing an unexpected recovery from the hit. Kind of roll back 10, I don't know how many years, since 2017, Apple ad revenues have grown from $300 million to $4 billion. And analysts believe Apple could be sitting on a potential $10 billion ad business. Currently, ad revenues account for only 2% of Apple's vast profits, but seem to be an increasingly lucrative part of the business. And Matt, I'm going to come to you here. We could throw out, Apple, is it an ad industry blocker or ad tech player? But really, what I'd like to know is your thoughts about what do Apple's latest privacy measures mean for the ad tech industry?
So firstly, I think Apple mess sounds like a delicious dessert and I want to know more about that. But in
evolution of eaten mess.
Exactly. But in terms of the changes that were talked about in the articles, I don't really think people should be surprised or scared of the changes. I don't think we should be surprised to see a crackdown on the use of IP addresses. That's kind of been bracketed under fingerprinting measures for some time. So I think any further crackdown on that shouldn't really be seen as a surprise. And as Kieran, our CEO, often says, you can't hack privacy. And I don't think advertisers should have to. Tracking for the sake of tracking shouldn't be considered a kind of viable business model. And in terms of the changes, in terms of Hide My Mail, I think of it from a user perspective. As a user, all the email marketing I interact with is towards getting value, and it's that value exchange. Do I respond, for example, when Deliveroo tells me a new restaurant has opened up in my area? Not necessarily. But do I respond when Deliveroo gives me a voucher code for cheaper food? Yes, I do.
But you don't get pissed off when Deliveroo tell you about a new restaurant in the area, because it's the right information in the right environment,
exactly.
Right?
It's not annoying, but it's not necessarily interacted with. And it's, getting that right information across, that doesn't matter whether I'm Matt Broughton at emailprovider.com or whether I'm xyz44 at dog.cat. It's the same information's going through.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Ozzy, do you think, should the ad industry be concerned by the latest privacy features rolled out by Apple?
No. I actually like that they're trying to live their truth, right? I think Steve Jobs said something similar in 2010 or something, when he's really for privacy. I can't remember the quote for the life of me, but he was saying the users should have a choice and they should know how their information is being used and disseminated. And I think Tim Cook is trying to do the same thing here as well. And I think they're trying to do what they feel is best for their users. They released the browser change a few years ago around tracking online. So I don't think we should be scared of it. I think we should welcome it, because that's just another way of letting the general public know, hey, we've got your back, this is happening. Because there were so many times I use Ghostry and all these different apps, and I can see where I'm being tracked. I was looking at a DNS seminar yesterday talking about where I'm tracked online and what pings are going off everywhere. And I was just like, huh? And, and then I then tried to request my own personal data from some of the apps that I'm using. And it's really difficult to find, where your information is being shared, how it's being shared and what you're using for. And I'm a person that's a skeptic because I don't put as much stuff online as I should do. I try ways of not to put that much stuff of myself online because of, I'm just one of those people. But, if it's a company that I trust and I know they're doing something with it, I'm quite happy to divulge that information. So I think they will play a really important role in how the ad tech industry shapes up in the future. What compliance also means from a privacy perspective. I think they'll have an important part to play because they not only have the software, they have the hardware to control those environments in which people are in as well.
I'm curious to know, we said if it's a company I trust, I'm happy to share my information. Why? Are you looking for a value exchange? Are you looking for a better experience? What is it?
That's it. There's a value exchange. You're giving me X, I will give you Y. You want me to sign up for this product and service, but what are you giving me back in return? If it's to make sure that you can contact me so that I don't miss my delivery from Amazon, that's fine. I get that. If it's just to have it, then I probably don't want it. Because I sign up for one email and then I start getting like thousands and thousands of emails, and so I had to change.
Is that because you didn't read the 17,000 pages of terms and conditions? I want this now.
There's also that, but I do read it and I actively go, do not contact me for any promotional services or partner details to other organizations. So I think I think to your point, like the value exchange is really important for me in how I want to share my information, and turning off, that proposed. It's so funny because I was looking at it, and it's literally just like one click, just a thing that just that little action is costing them potentially up to that amount of money a year is actually ludicrous. It lets you know how much money they're actually making.
There you go.
You know, I think the value exchange really should flip it on its head. Maybe I should start a company where basically people, they say to people, we will give you a cent for every time you use your data online. Maybe that's what they should do, because then that way maybe people might feel inclined to, okay, you're monetizing me, but I don't get anything back of it. So maybe if you were to give me a cent from every dollar you spent using my data, you might actually find that actually people might be quite happy to go, yeah, that's fine, because every month I'm going to be making 10 grand. Because
Ozzy, you know, I see you setting up some sort of pyramid scheme here.
I'm not trying to, but
I mean, I'm sure there's a new word for it these days.
I did think of it as an extension on like a browser, like, you know, you could just do something like that, because I don't see why you shouldn't, you know, why are you the only one allowed to make money from my information? Why can't I make money from my own information? Because it's like data is queen, as they say, right? So
exactly. And it's not about big data, it's about small data, right?
Yeah, you know, so.
With that in mind, Matt, do you think, you know, is this a sign that the ad industry can remain calm about potential changes?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, like you say, it's about giving users that choice. If they, you know, don't necessarily want their, you know, personal email identifier to be relayed to, you know, several thousand companies and then lost through some kind of data breach, I think the ad industry should accept that. And I think, like I said earlier, you know, you shouldn't try and just work around these privacy changes when they are in the interest of the user. I think the, you know, you mentioned earlier in terms of kind of us living in a ad tech bubble, we should, you know, look outside that and remember who we are as users and how we use the internet.
That's a really good point, but I'm still curious to know whether or not Apple's creating kind of an ad tech giant.
I think they are. I think they see the value in being in that space. I think every other technology company has tried in some shape or form to create its own ecosystem. Obviously with, you know, Google some while back, you have Facebook, you know, they see the value in purchasing these other organizations. Then Microsoft, everybody thought they were like dead and buried. Mm. And then all of a sudden they then came out and was like, oh, we'll acquire this and we'll merge with that. And then we'll buy LinkedIn and we'll do all these other bits and pieces. And then all of a sudden Microsoft in about 10, 15 years is, you know, really back up there.
Yeah.
And there are some other tech players who are still struggling. So I think you almost have to adapt and evolve. So I don't see them not wanting to be in the space. I think they definitely want, they have the device to get at you, right? All three of us have Macs as we speak right now. So
yep.
So I definitely see them going a lot more into that space.
I have an Android phone though, just, you know.
Me too. I have an Android phone. I wish Samsung would make a really slick laptop, then I might swap.
I would definitely. I'll go with my TV and my fridge.
Yeah,
and
Samsung
my and my washing machine. Yeah. I mean, talk about brand loyalty.
Exactly. If anyone from Samsung's listening, just, you know, there's some slick laptops. You've got me as a customer. It's just me.
Matt, any orders for any goods out there for our listeners or anything you'd like to add there?
I mean, yeah, definitely Samsung, give me all the stuff. But in terms of just going back to the point on Apple kind of positioning itself as a major advertising player, yeah, completely agree there that they are doing it. I think it's kind of a longer term play. I think at the moment they're kind of prioritizing getting into the finance and payment space. Obviously, they acquired MobiWave last year. Was it 2020? One of the two. And they're also, according to, I think it was Bloomberg today, kind of developing their own payment processing technology. So I think that's kind of their focus at the moment, especially in terms of their kind of scrutiny on their commission rates in terms of App Store, obviously in terms of the Epic Games case. So I think they're just trying to consolidate things in financial space. But in terms of getting into advertising, yeah, I think definitely it's a kind of long-term play. And I think they're kind of involvement in sports, I think that could be a very interesting route in there. There's speculation they're going to do a lot of bidding on NFL.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've heard in terms of the likes of Netflix and Facebook getting more into sports. Exactly.
As well. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think, you know, adding that into their portfolio, I think at that point they may be comfortable, like Disney are at the moment with their content portfolio, to start adding that kind of ad-funded tier. And then obviously with the devices and that kind of network as well, it could be very enticing.
I think also with the devices, like it's the sales have slowed down. Like the growth hasn't been in the way that they would maybe have liked for it to be, mainly because of the new players in the market. I think like for like, had there not been for the case that Huawei had, you know, they would be really big like this year, you know. But obviously they've got some issues that they're working their way through. But also like Samsung have really steamrolled the market with their products and offering as well. So I think that's the same signaling that actually this is not the area of growth when they can move into like ad tech in that way, you know. So yeah, and content as you said as well. So.
Totally talking agree. About content, I'm going to move on to the third story because this is about BuzzFeed News being under pressure. We were talking about subscription models there. We're talking about content. We're talking about sport. And here you've got BuzzFeed. So they set out its news stall in 2010 and going on to create Pulitzer-winning journalism and breaking exclusives. But recently news has become seen as what some might call an albatross around the neck of BuzzFeed because they're losing $10 million per year. They've got, I think, about 100 staff. So sharp cuts have been made in recent years and their CEO has been encouraged to cut his losses and shutter the news division. That's 100 people out of a job potentially straight away, right? Now, BuzzFeed's stock rose 6% as the news of further cuts, but the move was met with resistance and the BuzzFeed union is set to strike. That's never a good position. Apparently, one shareholder told CNBC, shutting down the newsroom could add up to $300 million of market cap to the struggling stock. The digital media company went public via a special purpose acquisition back in December, and the shares immediately fell nearly 40% from their first week of trading and haven't recovered. So, as BuzzFeed News faces potential closure, what can news brands do to ensure they stay commercially viable? Ozzy, I'm going to come to you on that one, please.
It's a touchy subject for me.
I work
in news. I'm a publisher.
Yeah.
You know, I work within publishing, and you know, work for, you know, a really trusted news brand. And I just think there's just no getting away from the numbers, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you said it there. You know, they came in via SPAC and, you know, $10 a share drop into what it is, $5 at the moment. That's half of your market share gone just before that. And I think, you know, even prior to that, the company like ages ago, I think was valued at almost like $1 billion or something like that. But, you know, I think I looked at some other numbers that they had in terms of loss EBITDA earnings or one of the reports anyway, and it was showing that, you know, they were losing something like $26 million or $25 million a year. It's quite large numbers to swallow. You know, like having 20 something million less in the bank this year than the year after, I think it comes a point where you almost have to go, actually, you know, is this working for us? I just think like the news category is a really aggressive place to be anyway.
Yeah.
Like ultimately, I think if you are in that space, you because did they purchase HuffPost?
They did. Yeah.
Did they? Yeah. I think it's a really hard place to be. So they are there and they have HuffPost, but then also you have all the other players in the market as well. I think most people will like to consume their news from one specific source. And I think, you know, I don't want to use the words like they sensationalize stuff. I don't want to use that word because I want to be very careful and respectful, obviously, to them. But, you know, when I think of like my primary news source, you know, I don't personally think I want to go to BuzzFeed. And I think when you look at it in that way, in terms of like what your preference is, then actually it stands to reason why they might not be doing as well as they want to do commercially. But yeah, it's a shame, you know, and for anyone who has to lose their jobs, and that no one likes to hear that, especially in the age we are right now. But yeah, I can't really speak too much on their strategy because I don't know nearly enough about the workings there. But you know, but what I will say is if it keeps the company overall like alive,
and
then I think that it's a good move. You know, that's kind of like I think that's my initial thoughts on it anyway for now.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think there's been, we need to be a bit more respectful and mindful of the kind of current climate that we're living in the past 2 years that we've lived in. And personally, I think people turned off news because it was quite depressing. And they went to other outlets. I think previously, Matt, was it the Wall Street Journal bought a company, a sports company or the sporting, whatever, maybe it wasn't them, but
is it the Atlantic you're thinking of?
Maybe. And they were smart because they've gone into a whole environment where people are going and they're giving them information in a place that they're spending time. And I think hopefully this will be short-term pain for long-term gain and they will kind of look at what they can do.
Yeah, I personally just thought they should have diversified. Like, you know, if you're creating a news agency, like I think the name BuzzFeed is like super, super cool.
Mm.
Right? You know, like in terms of new age media in that sense, it almost sounds like something kind of like a Marvel like series, like, you know. So I think they should have found a way to diversify to reach a different type of audience. I do believe they're still doing stuff on like TikTok and maybe focus on like entertainment only,
yeah,
and sports and lifestyle. I think there's a focus to kind of keep some aspects of that there, but I definitely feel like, you know, maybe it wasn't for them to go and do the whole news agency thing in the way they should have done it.
Yeah.
You know, they could have found a different way to reach a different type of market. Maybe more like, you know, quirky market, like just a different market than what everybody else is doing.
Because yeah.
You know, that's what I think anyway.
That's a fair point. Perhaps they kind of need to look at, well, who are they and what's their USP in a way? And are they looking at more responsible reporting? And if so, how do they balance the kind of the commercial necessity with whatever path they venture down next? Matt, do you have any thoughts on that?
Just on that final point in terms of their how they're pivoting as a business. Obviously, you know, in terms of their statement they released as part of the layoffs, we will prioritise investments around coverage of the biggest news of the day, culture and entertainment, celebrity and life on the internet. Ordinarily, I'd say that's obviously a great shame to go from that Pulitzer Prize-winning aspect of journalism to focus on that. But for BuzzFeed, that's what BuzzFeed is. So it kind of feeds into that. One point, though, I did want to kind of focus on is, you know, in terms of hard-hitting news journalism, how can, you know, just the ways in terms of advertisers support that, using the kind of series of the articles on treatment of Muslims in the Xinjiang province as an example. On those articles, there was no major brand in sight. I looked through it and there was a small training supplier, a random reseller of Intel processors, a mobility and living aids company, and a bathroom supplier from the East Midlands. Now, when I switched focus and looked on a BuzzFeed article, BuzzFeed.com, literally just 50 tweets about Bridgerton Series 2. No extra context, no extra layering in on that. The advertisers you were getting on that, you had Formula One, Party Poker, there was an international engineering group, British Airways, Pampers, Currys, Sony, Deliverer and Visa. And I think that just goes to show there is a bit of a juxtaposition in terms of, obviously, brands do have to, you know, keep brand safety in mind, but also look after, you know, hard-hitting investigative journalism. And I think the kind of way they can explore that, and I think which is coming, thankfully, into greater focus, is that greater emphasis on ESG and actually building that as a meaningful kind of measure of company success. It may encourage publishers which don't necessarily focus on that investigative journalism side to actually go, yes, we are losing a bit of money here on this, but it's very important for maintaining that kind of, you know, the social part of that ESG governance. And I hope it'll make brands feel more comfortable at either advertising against such content or supporting it via funding.
This is the holy grail, right? So how are issues with brand safety for advertisers being addressed and how are they overcoming this? And is this perhaps a cause here, you know? Ozzy, what are your thoughts here? I mean, should there be, I don't know, more support through GARM, etc.?
Yes.
Is this, I mean, do you think this is part of the problem perhaps BuzzFeed were facing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps.
It's kind of, it's tricky, isn't it?
It's a really hard one because I don't know if it's all down to that, you know, it could just be also a lack of like appetite from the consumers and users, you know, to want to consume the news on that website. If you don't have, if you don't have the users, you don't have the traffic, you don't have the inventory, and then you can't monetize it, right? On one side. And then on the other side is if the brands feel like some of the content perhaps, you know, can be a little bit obtruse, it could be a little bit, you know, sensitive, then they might feel like actually it's not the right environment for us to also be around. I think the things like the GARM framework will help all publishers who operate in the new space in the long term. I think it will allow them to have a better structure and an infrastructure, especially around how they can ensure that, you know, miscategorization and is adhered to at all levels. But I still think that's a long way away, right? But, you know, I think premium publishers who already operate in that space, in that brand safe space, most of them already practice this and they pretty much live it and do it all the time. They have to do that because the reputation of their brand like relies on it. There are some news publishers that don't even want to carry some contentious brands within oil and gas or within some spaces. And there are some news publishers who do want to carry those clients in some spaces for their own reasons and rightly so. But then there are other organizations that perhaps aren't necessarily like news publishers, or they publish news, but do they publish the news that, you know, as a professional, I want to consume? Perhaps not.
But when you take your professional hat off, you know, do you, that different persona, maybe you might want to consume it then. Yeah. I'm not saying you're different
you're right. Yeah, perhaps. But it's really difficult for me to be a different person in a professional capacity, because most of the time, like, I know that working at Reuters, like, I would find it... I find it difficult to go to other news organizations and read some of the stuff that they write, because I'm like, that's a bit too much, or that's a bit far leaning this way, and that's far leaning that way, just because of, you know, I've been at my company a while and I understand the value and the power of words. And I think those words, you know, they might just seem like just words to some people, but actually, you know, it's a way of, you can indoctrinate like your readers, you know, by some of the stuff you say. So I think it's really important to like not minimize that, you know, whilst they are a news organization, perhaps it just wasn't to the liking of some people. I don't think we can say apples and pears, it's because specifically because of brand safety. And I can't say that because I just don't know. And I can't say it's because they didn't have the users. But, you know, I think that's kind of like my way of answering that question. I'm probably just going to sit on the fence for a little bit longer until I know a bit more, or I have some inside info. But
that's fair enough.
Yeah, but I just think news is a challenging space to be in. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be, you know, the Reuters of the world, and you could be whoever else you want to be. And it's a really challenging space for companies and brands. And, you know, even at Reuters, we're a premium publisher, we're trusted, we are the source of news, but we still get lots of like emails and conversations and pushbacks around like brand safety.
Yeah.
Even though people know who we are, they know the work that we do, we work with Thomson Reuters, who are our sister company, and we work with other organizations also who we see as our competitors, you know. But we still get pushback on brand safety, you know. So I don't think anyone's immune from it, if that's the right word. I'm saying. So,
no, nobody's immune. But that's not a bad thing. You know, hopefully it'll keep us on track.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
But talking about premium publishers and talking about yourself, can I use this opportunity to kind of take us into the second part of the podcast, where we find out a little bit more about you and what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm gonna. So, me, what am I up to? I guess in my personal life, not a lot. Just chilled, trying to fix a little mouse problem I have. So that's been keeping me quite busy. In my professional life, I think like we're just really trying to grow. I think, you know, Reuters is, well, Reuters Professional, which sits within the Reuters News Agency and Reuters, which also then sits within Thomson Reuters. Like, Reuters Professional, like my department, is certainly one of the fastest growing parts and units within the Thomson Reuters group and also within Reuters. We have exceeded expectations, and we are looking to do even more this year. There's been a lot of investment into the organization, specifically our team. You know, we relaunched the Reuters.com website last April, so it'll be a year old, and that's the first digital transformation the site has had in probably like 15 years or something. Wow. 10-15 years, a really long time. And that's primarily because we've never really been known as, you know, a media owner or media publisher in that sense. We're like a news, we're a news agency. That's what we do, that's our prime goal. We will never deviate from that. But actually, we actually understand the importance of you know, giving people and giving professionals, you know, because I think what we're trying to do is capture a prosumer audience, which is what we call it, professional consumer, you know,
prosumer.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of like we wanted to like create our website to give professionals the right information they need to make educated decisions that might impact their business. You know, how do we do that? And that's kind of what this whole journey is about. So we've made lots of hires, and we're still making hires. We have a few open roles if anyone wants to reach out. But beyond that, we are growing our understanding of like our audience, like, you know, first party audience. Like, what does that mean? So we're encouraging users to sign up so we can have a little bit more information about them, so we can ensure that we're serving them the right ad in the right context. But then we're also building out our custom content capabilities as well in that space, and we're building out our events business. We acquired that business in 2-3 years ago, just before lockdown, and that's growing immensely. So we have a lot of marquee events. We, you know, get some really C-suite audience who come there, 15,000, 10,000, 15,000 plus,
wow,
who come to those like marquee events. So we, you know, one's called Responsible Business Summit. Then we have Reuters Impact, which is really around ESG and sustainability measures as well. And we have like the Global Outlook Summit. We have quite a few of them. And all of those different parts of the business are all growing and doing a lot there. So our main aim is just, you know, one, trying to manage that growth and expectations, but also ensuring that, you know, we're taking the customers as well on that journey with us. You know, so as and when we have new custom formats or new opportunities, like, let's ensure that they can also feed into that and they can help us along the way as well. So it's still very early stages. It's still got a lot of work to do, but you know, I think last week was the first time we'd probably in a while done like the Brand Safety Summit. Like, you know, I was there, and then we were also at the Festival of Marketing as well. And obviously I'm going to be with you guys at ATS. So, but we want to make sure that, you know, people are seeing us and they understand kind of who we are as an organization, what we're doing. There are lots of, you know, media is in the media agency world. There are lots of people who come in and still have no clue who Reuters are. Like, they're like, oh, Reuters? Like, what do you guys do? And I'm like, yeah. So we're probably the guys who get the information first before it reaches you. You know, by the time it reaches you, it's probably like second hand, third hand, you know. So we want to try and make sure people know who we are, and we're in that space. And, you know, I've been here for what will be 6 years, well, almost 6 years actually. And I've seen a lot of change and the investment coming in, and we've got some really bright minds pushing the team, pushing ideas forward. So it's a really exciting time and place to be. So really looking forward to kind of what this year has to hold and the years after that as well. You know, I can't say that, so I won't say that.
Oh, no, that's the bit that we really want to hear, isn't it, listeners?
I wanted to say something, but hopefully
you'll hear about it. We'll have to bring you back.
Because we are a technology company as well as a news organization. And I think sometimes people don't know that and aren't aware about it. So we build tech as well. So there is some stuff we want to do in that space as well, to ensure that we're also standing out from everybody else.
Interesting. So, it's the evolution of the publisher, isn't it?
It is. It is very much so. You know, we've also got, you know, we're trying to do our own thing in the audio space, you know, and in the video space. Yeah, there's lots of stuff that's happening internally. But, you know, we're still a news agency. That's our primary goal. We can't get away from that. You know, we have some really big customers that we service with information. You know, we power newsrooms and we power the global financial markets as well. You know, I think our news probably, you know, touches in the billions a day in terms of some of the information that we publish. So, you know, factual accuracy, ensuring that we have no bias is really important in what we do. So we will never stray from that. And that's kind of like who we are as a business. That's our core ethos. And we live by that because that's the Thomson Reuters trust principles. Yeah. And those trust principles is everything that we have to abide by as an organization. So definitely want to say we're growing our media capability and that space, but we're definitely still very much 100% committed to ensuring that no one that works with us from an agency perspective feels like we're not doing what we need to do in that space as well.
Wow. Exciting times. A lot going on. Growth, hiring. What a wonderful way to finish this podcast, because we're out of time, but it's great to finish up on such kind of a positive note. So that's it. There's nothing else for me to say apart from thank you so much, Ozzy, for coming in and being our guest.
Thank you for inviting me in. I loved it.
Brilliant.
My first podcast. I love it. It was great.
Excellent. And Matt, as always, thank you.
Thank you, AMS.
That's this week's Exchange Wires Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you. Goodbye.